everyone, I'm John Offit. I'm a broadcaster based in the UK, and welcome to Different Minds, a podcast series that looks at neurodiversity, the different ways our brains can work and interpret information. This podcast is proudly sponsored by Aspire Autism Consultancy, the leading providers of autism and ADHD training, educating and enabling families, therapists and healthcare professionals to gain knowledge and understanding of neurodiversity. The courses are written by two specialist psychotherapists and include the voices and lived experiences of neurodivergent individuals. For further details, go to www.aspireautismconsultancy.co.uk. I'm delighted to be joined by Geek Girl author Holly Smale. Holly was recently diagnosed with autism at the age of 39. Holly, the writer of the best-selling Geek Girl series, has sold more than 3 million books, but she's never felt like she fits in. Holly gives talks on stage to thousands, but has never had a serious relationship, and now she thinks she knows why. Holly, welcome to Different Minds.
Hi, thanks for having me.
No worries. So, how are you? How has 2021 been for you?
Yeah, it's been a bit of a roller coaster. I think probably much like most of us, it has been a very up and down struggle with some silver linings. But yeah, on a personal level, it's been a slightly weird time as well. So obviously I got my diagnosis at the end of last year. So I've been kind of dealing with that emotionally and trying to find out as much as I can, which it's been a weird one.
So before I come to your autism diagnosis, just for those listeners that don't know, can you tell us about the Geek Girl series?
Yeah, so it was a series I started writing about 2009, but there are 8 novels about a book called a character called Harriet Manners, who's a teenager. She struggles, she's very geeky, very smart, very unpopular, struggles with social interaction, struggles to communicate with the world, sees everything through lists and facts and statistics, hides under tables when she's overwhelmed, and struggles to kind of process her emotions and the world around her. And that was the book series that I based my entire career on, not realizing, of course, that she was anything other than just a geeky teenage girl.
So you were diagnosed with autism last year at the age of 39. Just tell us how that diagnosis came about.
So I'd obviously spent all these years writing about Harriet, and the word autism had come up quite a lot of times, from parents, from students, and I'd always said, no, I'm not autistic, therefore I think that Harriet's probably just geeky, which looking back is slightly mind-blowing. But I assumed, if I had been autistic, I'd have been caught at school, and obviously that's not true at all, but I just assumed, as everyone does, that is what happens. So last year when lockdown happened, obviously I came off the kind of treadmill of writing books and promoting books and going to school tours and that kind of thing, and I had a lot of time, and I struggled with my mental health, as I'm sure many of us did, and in the summer I had a particularly scary meltdown, which I've had previously but which was particularly terrifying, and I decided that I needed to find out more and ask more questions about why I was struggling this way, and I was googling things like, why don't I understand other humans? Why do I keep melting, like having meltdowns? What's wrong with me? And the same word kept popping up. And so I spent one night until about 4 in the morning just googling everything I could find on female autism. And by the end of the night, I was like, this seems like a slam dunk to me. And it was emotionally overwhelming. And it took me a few months to get a clinical diagnosis, but I kind of knew by the end of that night, I knew I was autistic.
And how did that make you feel when you came to that realization?
It was a mixed bag, and it still is, to be honest. At the time, I was just, shocked and ironically unable to process, because it felt like such a huge thing to have been missed for nearly 4 decades. It was a word that I thought of that applied to other people, not to me. And so I had to try and wrap my head around that, and I had to try and see my life through a new lens, which brought with it, you know, emotions of relief, because suddenly everything started to make sense. It was literally like turning a light on, and I was like, I suddenly understand all the difficulties, all the traumas, all the things I'm extremely good at, all the things I'm extremely bad at. Like, suddenly everything makes sense. But there's also grief that comes with that, because, you know, 4 decades of not knowing who you are and struggling because of it, essentially, and feeling confused all the time, and also, you know, a slight anger towards some of the adults that perhaps should have been keeping a closer eye on me, maybe. So yeah, it's been a roller coaster, which has ultimately ended up with me feeling very happy and relieved and in an extremely positive way. But you know, it's not all been a straight, smooth, plain sailing.
Why do you think it's becoming more and more common for adults later in life to receive an autism diagnosis?
Well, I mean, I was born in 1981, which was the same year that Asperger's syndrome was even actually coined. And it didn't enter the DSM until I was 13. So it would have been very, very, very unlikely for me in the early 80s to have been spotted as a girl. I think more importantly, like, historically, autism study has been biased towards boys. It has been focused on boys, the way that they have studied it. You know, there's a lot of theory that has never really been substantially proved scientifically that has been applied across the board, which means that a lot of people have been missed out, people who don't fit the criteria that people assumed was so rigid, and especially when it's gendered. So, for instance, you know, a lot of the things I was showing at school, had I been a little boy, would have been picked up perhaps quicker. So, for instance, you know, I used to have meltdowns that were completely uncontrollable and sort of physically sometimes quite violent, and I was told I was dramatic. I used to hide in cupboards and under tables, and I was told I was sensitive. I used to have absolute obsessions that I needed to know everything about. I once made a school project about the Tudors. Every single year for about 5 years, every single project, didn't matter if it was art or history, I made them all about Tudors. But that was just me being you know, geeky. Everything that basically I, you know, my need to not be dirty because I'd become hysterical was just me being a clean little girl. So gendered language, gendered expectations meant that all of the diagnostic criteria became just sort of dismissed when it came to me, especially because I was very, very clever. And so my hyperlexia basically had me just sort of regarded as just a clever little girl who's a little bit odd.
And how does autism present itself in women?
I mean, I think we're still working it out, essentially. I think that's why there's so many of us being found now. There's a lost generation of women and girls who got missed through the 80s and 90s. Yeah. So I think that's why you've got so many women in their 30s now going, oh, my goodness. But, it's essentially the same diagnostic criteria that it just is sometimes in a kind of feminine language sometimes. So, you know, if a little boy has 100 trains and lines them up in a neat row, people will sort of, you know, notice and maybe pay more attention. If a little girl has 100 Barbies or fluffy dogs and lines them up in a row, everyone will go, oh, cute, isn't that just a sweet girly thing to do? Yeah. So, you know, just because my interests might sometimes have been slightly more on the arts side of things or slightly more on the feminine side of things, it didn't mean that they weren't the exact same things. And also with masking, so they know that they know now that with girls and women we tend to mask more quickly, just partly because culturally we're expected to fit in, you know, we're expected and we kind of have to, from a safety basis, to blend in as much as we can to make people like us, which means that from a really young age we're learning how to not be ourselves, essentially, and how to act like other people. And I remember starting to do that when I was 3.
Right.
And watching people around me, watching their facial expressions, the way that they spoke to each other, what they spoke about, the way they moved, and trying to study it so that I could be like them. And, you know, that's something that girls potentially do more or with, you know, greater success than boys, which means that you've got all these little girls who are, you know, deeply traumatized but have essentially managed to fit in, even though, you know, they knew that there was something different about them.
So Holly, I just wanted to ask you about relationships. I've obviously read up about you before we did the interview today, and mentioned you've never had a serious relationship before. I just wondered, you know, what some of those challenges are that you face, and yeah, why you think that is essentially.
I mean, honestly, I'm still working through it myself, but it's So obviously, I mean, you guys will know this. It's a podcast, especially about the neurodivergence. But obviously, autism, word auto, comes from self, and you know, sometimes self-containment. And with me, that definitely is the case. And my kind of natural state is to be alone. And so sometimes I struggle. And honestly, with a relationship, it's so many things that I am not necessarily good at thrown into the mix. You know, I have to try and read their, you know, their nonverbal communications. I have to read between the lines. I have to work out what they're feeling and how I'm feeling, and their expectations. And it becomes quite overwhelming and confusing a lot of the time. So I think it historically has ended up just sort of breaking down, whether it's my end or their end or both ends. And I've just kind of ended up thinking that it was more easy and simple to be by myself, which, you know, I'm happy like that. But it's not an easy state for me to be with another person, or intimate with another person. And I don't just mean romantically. It can be, you know, as a friendship, or even with a member of family, you know, a few hours and I'm kind of done. It takes me a long time to recover from intimacy on any level. So yeah, I can't imagine that's made it very easy. And I'm also quite bewildering, I think, for the boyfriends I have, who don't expect to get what I give in a relationship, maybe.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. And I guess, you know, obviously the fact that you have so much self-awareness, you know, I guess that helps, doesn't it, as well?
It can, it can, but it can also be slightly sometimes too much self-awareness. But yeah, I mean, I try to be honest with myself about situations, and, you know, my love life is one of those. And, you know, essentially, I've never met anyone that I wanted to spend a lot of time with, essentially. And it has, and I'm not going to lie, you know, unfortunately, especially with autistic people, we tend to, because we're very honest and we tend to see things very black and white, right and wrong, good and bad. We tend to assume everyone else is like that as well. So we can be quite trusting and vulnerable in that way, which means in relationships that can be, well, not even just in relationships, but with, you know, anything romantic or sexual, that can be a difficult area, because we don't see warning signs, we don't see abuse necessarily until it's too late. And I've definitely experienced that myself. You know, I've been, you know, lied to and cheated on for months and months and months before I noticed. And, you know, manipulated. It can be quite an unpleasant arena to be in when you lack the ability, perhaps, or the strengths of observation without verbal, acknowledgement.
And I guess, you know, ultimately, you know, obviously there are couples out there, one of them being neurotypical, one of them being autistic, in long-term relationships, and it can work, and it's about,
of course, happiness,
isn't it, on both sides.
Yeah, and also, you know, I didn't know myself, so there's a huge thing to be said that, you know, I haven't really dated, well, I've only dated one person once since my diagnosis, that was hilariously terrible, you know, I think there's a lot to be said for the fact that I didn't know that I was autistic, which meant that I was still masking really heavily on all of my dates and in my relationships, because, you know, I'm sure that anyone who is autistic and hears this will know what it's like to have yourself constantly picked apart by the people that are around you. Not always in a bad way, not even an intentionally harmful way, but just in a, that's weird, why would you say that? Why would you do this? Why would you stand like that? And in a relationship, especially when it's quite new, that happens a lot. And so you kind of change, you try and alter yourself on like a micro level to make sure that they don't think you're weird and that they don't reject you for being an oddball. And you don't realize until the end of a relationship that you've essentially spent a relationship flogging yourself to try and get yourself to be acceptable and who they want. And that's not a recipe for actual intimacy.
No, absolutely.
So, yeah. No.
So what would you say, Holly, to, you know, often you sometimes hear people say, well, you know, everyone's a bit autistic, you know, I like to stick to my routine and I like to know what I have for breakfast every day. And, you know, what would you say to, when people say that to you?
I understand the impulse for people to say everyone's a bit autistic, and people have said it to me multiple times since my diagnosis. And I think what we have to make clear is that, you know, neurologically, we are different. We autistic people are built differently. So we experience the world differently. We communicate differently. My senses are very different to the kind of neuronormative way of experiencing light and sound and touch. So basically, we are living in a world that's not built for us. And yes, of course, every human is different. That goes without saying. And of course, there are going to be huge crossovers between someone who's socially anxious and an autistic person, and someone who is sensitive to sound and an autistic person. And, you know, that is going to happen. But because with autism, you've got all of that happening in, like, you know, kind of to a huge degree from birth. You know, you are, by saying everyone's a bit autistic, what you're doing is dismissing the damage and the trauma that we've had to deal with just by having a different neurotype. And of course, there are similarities, but it doesn't mean you've experienced it like a neurodivergent person has. Does that make sense?
Perfect sense. I just wondered, Holly, what do you think needs to be done in society to kind of further our understanding of autism? Because essentially, you still have in 2021 people in influential positions in academia and many other industries that are hiding the fact that they are autistic.
Yeah, I know. You know, and what's upsetting as well is that, you know, since I came out or however you put it, about a month ago, a lot of people have contacted me to say I can't say I'm autistic because I'm worried about being fired, and I'm worried about, you know, how people will treat me, and I'm losing my career and losing my relationship. It's really, really scary and sad. And I do feel like I'm in a position of privilege, and I was able to kind of talk out about it because I didn't feel that the risk to my career or my income was going to impact me too severely. So that does put me in a position of privilege. But I think that, you know, one thing that those of us who can talk about it, if we can try and change the way that the world sees it, because the way that they see it right now is the way that, you know, science has positioned it for 100 years, which is inaccurate, and it's negative, and it's deficit based. It is basically what can't you do that we can do as neurotypical people, yeah, as opposed to what can neurotypical people do that you can't do as neuronormative people. I struggle to have a conversation and read facial cues and emotion, you know, not because I lack empathy, but just because I don't process it in the same way. But I have talents and skills that are far beyond anyone that I know who's neuronormative. And I think it's about repositioning it as we are not lesser. We do not have less worth. We are not broken. We are not to be studied and pulled apart by people who think that we are fascinating freak shows. We are valuable, we have strengths, and we are to be celebrated. We are a different neurotype, and that is it. And frankly, throughout history, there are many, many people who created the world in terms of art, in terms of architecture, in terms of, you know, every area, science, who were almost definitely autistic. So I think it's about reframing the way that we look at autism, and hopefully the more we do that, the more people will be encouraged to come out and say, yeah, I am autistic too, and hopefully that conversation keeps opening up until it's no longer something to be ashamed of or scared of. So yeah, I mean, that's something that I'm quite passionate about.
Do you think there's sometimes a misunderstanding of what autism is? Because essentially, as you know, autism is a spectrum, and you know, you get people like yourself on one end of the spectrum, and people that are perhaps non-verbal and are not able to articulate or communicate how it is for them on the other end of the spectrum, and some people might think, well, how can they have the same condition?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the worst things, and I say one of the worst things because frankly the study and history of autism has been just rife with like horrible ethical, like just horrible things. I mean, I can't, my brain actually explodes even trying to think about it. But also inaccuracies, and the idea of it as a spectrum, especially a linear one from mild to extreme, is inaccurate. And anyone, any scientist who tells you that it isn't, that that is how it is probably a neurotypical person who doesn't really understand a neurodiversity properly, because it's not a mild to extreme spectrum, and it never has been. There are speaking people, there are non-speaking people. Doesn't mean that we're not experiencing the world in the same way. And also it doesn't mean that we are set in our own so-called functioning. You know, I have days where, you know, I'm hyperlexic, so I can have lots of meetings and do lots of talks. But I then have 3 days where I can't speak at all. And that is, you know, the idea of a spectrum from mild to severe, just because people see me on the so-called high end of that functioning spectrum, which doesn't exist, doesn't mean that I don't like struggle immensely when they don't see. So you know, the reality is, if there is a spectrum, it's more of a color wheel, and we all
I've heard the spectrum being called more like a constellation in a way. Does that fit?
Yeah, I mean I'm a big fan of stars, so yeah. That works. I think it's just important to move away from the idea, and I've had that since my diagnosis, how can you compare yourself to, you know, properly autistic people, would be the quote. And I'm like, I'm as autistic as they are. It doesn't mean that just because I'm hyperlexic, I'm not also, you know, struggling immensely with so many different areas. So I think it's important to, you know, kind of make people understand that it is not a, it's not a mild to severe spectrum, which means that everything they know about autism essentially is wrong.
And I guess the terms like high functioning are quite harmful, aren't they, in terms of the language that is used?
Absolutely. You know, what is high functioning? I can go, you know, I can go days when I'm burnt out, when I'm, my senses have been, you know, overwhelmed, without being able to walk properly, without being able to speak, without being able to get dressed. And that is not high functioning. So, you know, the fact that some days I can put on a dress and go to a party doesn't mean that I am high functioning. And similarly, just because you are deemed low functioning doesn't mean that you have, you know, that you don't have like incredible creativity and thoughts going on inside that you are, you know, that are not being listened to, essentially. So I think the conversation just needs to change, and it needs to move away from neurotypical people who are studying autism to neurodiverse people who are talking about it, because we know how it feels. And that's something that is quite a new shift, and hopefully it'll continue picking up pace.
Definitely. I want to get your thoughts on media representation of autism, because often in the mainstream media, when they portray an autistic person, they're either a superhero, you know, savant type character, or someone with high support needs that's perhaps non-verbals. It's one extreme or the other. I just wonder what your thoughts are on that.
Yeah, I mean, I think media needs, it's hilarious sometimes that, you know, a particular production company, streamer will, and I've heard this, I'm not going to name any names, but they say, we don't need another show, we've already got one autistic one, which is bonkers, because essentially you're saying that autistic people have one story and we've told that, so there's no, sorry, you're no longer relevant to the narrative. So, you know, we need to be showing different, you know, every, like as you say, a constellation or a color wheel, whatever it is, every autistic person is different, and we all have our stories, and our stories are not limited to us being neurodivergent. That is part of who we are, and it is who we are, but it doesn't mean we don't have stories as well. So I think it's about showing lots of different types of representation. I mean, hopefully, you know, with Harriet and Geek Girl, she, you know, the fact that she managed to go 10 years of 3.5 million books sold without that many people noticing she was autistic, shows you how few characters are out in the media as you know, openly autistic. And I'm currently, just for fun, kind of trying to pitch to the Simpsons, because Lisa Simpson is, well, I say trying to pitch, I'm tweeting at them, and I'm going to send letters. That makes it sound like I've actually got a meeting. I do not have a meeting, but I have been sending letters to organizations since I was 6 years old, so this is not my first rodeo. But I was a Lisa Simpson when I was younger, I was the exact same. I was vegetarian at the age of 4 because I just believed it was evil immediately, and you know, the fact that she has never been diagnosed autistic, and a lot of people are like, she's just really clever. Like, I was told I was just really clever for nearly 40 years. And actually, if you look at the diagnostic criteria, Lisa Simpson fits it completely. And I've had three psychologists tell me they agree.
Wow.
And it's crazy, because you just think, if Lisa Simpson was openly autistic, that would change the narrative of autism for the world. You know, it would change the way people look at girls, especially on the autistic spectrum. Like, it would change. I mean, it would do such enormous things for the media and for the way that we see things. Even my own dad, when he was very confused when I got my diagnosis, and he's neurotypical, and he was very confused and a bit, I guess, concerned, worried for me about speaking about it. And when I said, how would you feel if I said Lisa Simpson was autistic? And he went, oh, well, then I'd say you definitely are, because you're the same. Yeah, Lisa's, she's cool. And I was like, you see, the difference is that, you know, you take a beloved character that everyone loves and knows, and you say, yep, that's one example. And it changes the way people see it.
Yeah. So do you think, you know, there is lots of good work in the media at the same time as well. So you've got lots of productions now where, you know, they involve autistic people in the development phase of the actual production, rather than kind of dictating the stereotypes and the narrative in advance. They're kind of working with autistic people to shape the characters and the plot and kind of consult with them through the entire production. And you obviously, the reason I jump is obviously they work with an autistic focus group from the very beginning.
I saw that last week.
Right, yeah. So what did you think of that? It's a great documentary, isn't it?
Yeah, it was very interesting. And I think what I took away from it, as an autistic person, I mean, I found it overwhelming on a number of different levels. Emotionally, I found it overwhelming. Also because, I mean, interestingly, I think because it is potentially made kind of to speak to neurotypical people, the way the sound is done and the way the colors and the lights are done are to almost show neurotypicals what it feels like to be autistic, which is incredible. But if you are autistic, it's too much. You're like, I already see the world like this, and now it's like super heightened. And I found it quite, I should have gone to one of the more sensitive screenings, as in they've got new sensitive screenings where, like, you know, there's warnings, that kind of stuff, because I found it painful. But I think it's incredible in that, you know, it allows neurotypical people to maybe see a little bit more of what it's like. But the way that, the thing I took away from it was that, you know, although I am not non-speaking, as is very clear on this podcast, everything else is pretty much the same. I see the world in the same way. I see the details, I see the sound, I feel the sounds because I'm synesthetic. You know, I, so much of it is familiar. And I think that was what I took away, was that, you know, the ability to speak or not speak is not a definition of how you see the world, or what you experience. So yeah, it's great that they're involving autistic people, but I think it has to be more, you know, it has to be more autistic writers, more autistic actresses and actors, you know, be involved in sound production, be involved in, it should be across the whole board, so that we're involved.
We've got examples when you know, big production companies get it so wrong. So, you know, obviously, if I dare mention Sears later.
Yeah, I never saw it. I don't really want to see it. I think it can be, you know, I mean, the line, you know, nothing about us without us is so important, because, you know, essentially, I'm sure that Sia had no, quote, bad intentions. Yeah. But the reality is that when you turn someone's life experience into art and you shut them out of the narrative in order to do that by employing a neurotypical dancer to play a non-speaking autistic person, and it's written by a neurotypical, and the charities that she was speaking to are, you know, not loved by the autistic community.
Autism speaks there, aren't you? Yeah.
So yeah, and it's, I think that if you know, you can't make a story about someone or an experience without actually involving the people whose experience you're actually talking about. And it had that really uncomfortable messaging of that we are to be looked at and fetishized and, you know, kind of turned into these beautiful magical unicorn creatures that everyone can feel better about themselves. I don't know, it didn't sit right. you know, if it's an autistic story, it should be by an autistic person, and ideally starring an autistic person.
Yeah. And a question that I ask all my guests on my podcast series. So if you had the opportunity, Holly, what advice would you give your younger self?
I would tell my younger self, who I am still grieving for, to be frank, I would tell her that she is not broken. And I would tell her that the things that she was struggling with are okay, and that she hasn't done anything wrong, and that she is extraordinary, and that she will find people that love her for her, and that she will do things that she never thought capable of. So, you know, I would give her a hug, because the little version of me was really, really struggling, and was very alone. So that's what I would do. And I'll do that for, you know, in speaking out, hopefully I'm doing that for other little girls around the world who also feel like I did.
I really appreciate your thoughts, and thank you for sharing that with us today.
Thanks for having me and giving me the space to talk.